Hello, I am Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk. The Department of Economics at UBC is one of the world's best. In a recent ranking based on research publications, the department ranked in the top 20 worldwide and number one in Canada. Today on Prof Talk, Assistant Professor Mauricio Drelichman joins me from the UBC Department of Economics. Dr. Drelichman is a scholar in the Institutions, Organizations, and Growth Program of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. His main academic research area is economic history, with an emphasis on early modern Spain. His work has been published in some of the top economics and economic history journals worldwide. He's originally from Buenos Aires, Argentina, where he completed his BA and MA at the University of San Andrés in Argentina and his PhD at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Dr. Drelichman joins me now live in the CITR studio. Welcome, Mauricio, to Prof Talk.
Thank you, Farha. It's great to be here.
Now, let's begin a discussion about economic history as a field of study, since you're one of the key researchers in this area in your department. What exactly is economic history?
Well, there are two very different schools of economic history. At some very basic level, it is just learning the economic facts that happened long ago. We could just think of it as a branch of history that focuses on the economics of the past. However, we try to be a lot more ambitious than that. We try to use history as our teacher, to learn from history about the way humans behave and interact today, and about the way societies function. So when we look at the past, we can actually draw some useful lessons for today.
Now, would you say that economic historians like yourself are part economics, economists, sorry, part historians?
Definitely so. And, you know, you're a lot of the time feeling that you have to serve two masters. You have to please historians and you have to please economists. My advisor had a wonderful quip about this. He said that being an economic historian is like being Jewish. You are the chosen people, but that doesn't make life easier, it makes it harder.
Right. So, now, why is economic history important for understanding the trends of economies today?
Well, and here I'm going to draw again on a favorite quip by my doctoral advisor. His name is Joel Mokyre, a very famous economic historian. He used to say, history is destiny, right? And that means if you want to understand where you are today and where you're heading, you cannot do this without understanding where you have come from. If you take a look at the world today, you may feel compelled to diagnose a problem without knowing that really that problem is coming from the very distant past. And you are liable to make big mistakes if you do not take history into account.
Mm-hmm. And so what does economics learn from history?
Well, here, perhaps it's better to stop talking in the abstract and move to a few examples, right? Otherwise, I will just confuse people.
Yeah.
So, let's see. Let me draw on my own research. This is easiest. I know it best.
Yeah.
So, in one of my latest projects, I look at the determinants of sovereign defaults. That is, when do states and countries stop paying their debts? Okay. And this is very much a current topic. We have a debt crisis right now going on in Europe. There's talk about the increase in deficit and debt in the United States. So it is important to understand, first, why do states pay back their debts, given that there are no courts you can take a state to? And also, why do people keep lending to sovereigns, to people that can choose not to pay back their debts? By looking at contemporary events, we might feel confused. We do not observe a lot of the relevant data. A lot of these contracts are private. A lot are only disclosed long after the fact. And the buzz of current events is very fast. But we can look way into the past. And in my work, I have looked at the case of Philip II of Spain, who was one of the heaviest borrowers of his time. And he managed to attract a lot of international capital from Genoese bankers. And what we see there are the contracts between the king and the bankers. And we can actually read every single clause and then track every outcome of those debts. So we see what the incentives were, why the bankers were wanted to lend to the king, and why the king wanted to pay back. And here we learn about the role of reputation. The king wanted to borrow because he cared about certain things like fighting wars and needed money to do that, but he also wanted to pay back because he wanted to borrow more in the future. Okay? And bankers knew this, so bankers kept lending to him because they knew the king had an incentive to pay back. So in the long run, we observed that although there were rough times, the king didn't pay back on a few occasions, on average, the bankers still made money because the king found ways to compensate them for the times he didn't pay back. So this tells us that in modern day, it's very likely that reputation continues to play a big role. Perhaps many countries would be better off by defaulting, by stopping payments altogether, but they keep paying. Okay? And what they care about here is their reputation looking towards the future. They want to be able to keep borrowing, to continue participating in international markets.
Now, so when you're researching Spain, it's not necessarily you're looking at the economic economics of Spain today. It's just really looking at how economic history in Spain can relate to you know, economies all over the world.
Exactly. I actually don't look at the economics of Spain today at all. I couldn't tell you anything about them except... except from what I read from the news, right? So I specialize in learning about the economics of Spain in the 16th and 17th century, and here I can talk about them for hours and bore you to death if you want. But what I do is, from that expertise, I take lessons that can be applied not only in Spain, anywhere in the world today.
So let's backtrack a bit. You mentioned your supervisor. This was your doctoral supervisor in Illinois. Now, tell us about your research. What brought you to researching Spain, or you know, the economic history of Spain in this time period?
Well, I am afraid the answer is a bit of serendipity and luck. So I knew I wanted to study economic history. History was always a favorite subject of mine in high school and through college, but I also craved the right of mathematics, and economics seemed just a wonderful synthesis of all of that. Essentially, in economics, you're trying to explain different aspects of human behavior and choices made by people interacting with each other in society. So I decided to go to Northwestern because I knew Joel Mokyr was there, and a few other very good people roamed the department as well, but I had no idea on what I would write a dissertation on. And my second year in the program came around, and I found myself having to write a paper. And I knew about this source for Spanish prices that I could tap. And I got this idea of looking at the changes in how competitive Spain was when it started receiving a lot of silver and gold from its American colonies. And I just wrote a paper on that and became acquainted with the sources and kept digging deeper into it, and before I knew it, I had a dissertation on my hands. Now, once you delve deep into an area of economic history, this usually means that you have to become very familiar with the archives and the sources, and this takes a lot of work. So once you have acquired that expertise, it's just natural to continue on that track. So there's nothing terribly special about Spain. I just happened to become very good at using its sources and at learning its history.
And so the archival sources did you actually seek in Spain?
Yes, I travel quite a bit in Spain. On average, I spend there a month, a year or so. And what I do is go to archives where I know there are sources that I can use for my work. In the case of the sovereign debt contracts, for example, I went to the Royal Archive in the little town of Simancas, just outside Valladolid, that holds all the documents related to the royal administration. And one of these one series of documents has all these contracts. And you ask for the contracts, and you are brought a box full of 500-year-old pieces of papers, and you just get to read them one by one. And these days, you actually take digital pictures of them, load them onto computers, and then work on them in the comfort of your office.
That's a good addition, because we forget that. And so basically from those documents, you then start analyzing, you know, what the economy had looked like at this time.
Exactly. So First, one of the most important skills of the economic historian is actually to identify which documents are going to be good or not. Once you have done that, you can very quickly duplicate or capture them at the archive, bring them back home, and then start extracting the relevant information, which can be prices, can be quantities traded, can be conditions of contracts. There are a myriad of different things that you can get from historical sources. Once you have that, then you become an economist. You have to think about what is the economic relationship that your data can help shed light on. You build a model, and then you test the implications of your model using the data you capture.
Wow. So it really is that it is 50-50 from what you're telling us. You are a historian and you are an economist in the same.
That is correct. Although I would also say that that comes at a cost. You cannot be the best at everything. And so many times you look for collaborators that can help you shore up either the history part if you are delving in an area that is not the one of your expertise, or the economics part if you are going to deal with models that you do not know very well.
Right.
There are a few people that can be the best at both things, but most often you will look for assistance, and this will result in collaborative research projects.
Right. I want to mention the title of one of your papers because we are talking about your research of early modern Spain, and it's got a fantastic title. It's called Lending to the Borrower from Hell, Debt and Default in the Age of Philip II. Can you tell us specifically about that paper or a little bit more in detail?
Sure. So this is related to the project I mentioned before of the sovereign debt contracts of Philip II of Spain. And we call him the Borrower from Hell. This paper is joined with Hans-Joachim Voth, who is an economic historian at Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona, Spain. We call him the borrower from hell because in the roughly 40 years of his reign, he defaulted four times on his debt. And this is someone who would not be able to get a dime of credit today, right? And still we observe that international bankers keep lending to him time and time again. And so the question is, were these people out of their minds? Just kept giving them money for him not to pay it back, or was there something else? And what we found was that there was indeed something else. That these bankers, although from time to time they were not paid back, managed to get their money back and more in good times. That is, the rates they charged the king when he was paying back more than made up for the losses that they suffered when he did not pay back. And also, they had a system that always ensured that the king would try to settle with them after a default. The way they did that was they formed a network that aggregated 70% of the bankers. So if the king wanted any significant amount of money down the line, he had to settle with these guys. He could not do it without their support. So we showed that it was possible to lend to the borrower from hell, and that the borrower from hell was not that bad to deal with, after all.
That's just fantastic. Now, I'd like to talk about your involvement in the department, because you are quite active, and one of the things that you do is you put on these seminars in economic history. Can you tell us about them, and also who can attend them?
Sure. So the Department of Economics has actually a very active seminar programs in all areas of economics. If you check our website, which is www.econ.ubc.ca, and click on seminar listings, you will see that every week we have three or four research seminars in different areas. One of those areas is economic history. And what we do is we invite economic historians from all over the world, but predominantly from North America, to present their work in progress. And this is a research seminar, meaning that the papers that are going to be presented are not finished papers, and they are circulated prior to the presentation, and then the author comes in, talks about the paper, and we discuss it openly. The seminars are open and free. Anyone can come. In fact, I usually advertise them to my undergraduates and graduate students, and I sometimes get a good turnout, sometimes not. And they are a fantastic way of keeping up to date of what is the frontier of research in economic history. This is not something that was published last year. This is not something that is 10 years old. This is research that is taking place right now.
Excellent. And you're also teaching a graduate course at the moment, and it looks very interesting because it does relate a lot to your current research. It's attempting to explain why Western Europe ended up ruling over most of the rest of the world. And I was curious when I looked at the syllabus, is what are your students researching in this course now, since that we're almost at the end of the semester? Mm-hmm.
So this course has its main requirement that students write a research paper and exploring an economic history question. And I ask them to actually bring some originality to this. So it must not be just a literature review. And they have to have something new in the paper. So now, quoting from memory, I have five students conducting projects right now. One of them is looking at the determinants of countries adopting Protestantism over Catholicism after the Lutheran Reformation. Okay? There is a long-standing hypothesis that areas that were under the Roman Empire stayed Catholic, while areas outside the Roman Empire went Protestant. So he's examining that, whether it holds in an econometric framework. He's also trying to assess the importance of culture in the sense of religious fervor in certain areas staying Protestant or Catholic. So a number of there were always a number of political reasons for going Protestant or Catholic, right? Princes tried to negotiate with the Pope for staying Catholic, or went Protestant depending on whether this enhanced their political power. But it's also important to figure out what the will of the local population was. A prince needed local support. So he's trying to assess that by looking at the number of Catholic shrines in different areas and see if the areas that had more shrines stayed Catholic. Mm. So I'm looking forward to the results of that. A different student is looking at the regulation that was enacted after the South Sea Bubble. Now, the South Sea Bubble was a famous episode in the early London stock market around the 1710s, when the government tried to use a private company as a way of placing government debt. So it gave the company debt and allowed the company to issue shares. The company was also supposed to make profits by trading in the South Sea. It was called the South Sea Company. This fueled the speculative bubble. The prices for shares of the companies skyrocketed, and like all bubbles, it eventually burst. And so a lot of people lost their shirts. A lot of people made a lot of money because they got out of the bubble at the right problem. But this did not bide well for the development of a young stock market. So the government enacted a law called the Bubble Act that significantly curtailed the ability to trade, the things people could do in the stock market. So the student is looking at whether this act served the regulatory purpose or was more a way to appropriate wealth by certain actors in the market. Okay. I can go on and on. Yeah. You stop me.
No. So what has been the outcome of the course so far? I mean, what have students learned? You've been looking at so many issues, and even one of them, again, it was in your syllabus about why the Industrial Revolution actually happened in Western Europe. I mean, what are some of the discussions out of that?
So we are only now starting to talk about the Industrial Revolution. I just had held a midterm for this course, and I'm glad to report that grades were all very high. The first question I asked was, economic historians are fond of saying that history matters. Explain, why does history matter, right? So this is a totally broad question that lets them take any number of avenues to answer it, but it's really aimed at finding out if they are getting anything out of this course. And the broad answers you can give is that, yes, history matters because, as we talked at the beginning, understanding where you're coming from has a deep impact on understanding where you are today. And you could give different answers. History matters because the institutions that regulate your society today are very important in determining economic outcomes, but those institutions do not come via parachute, right? They are developed in historical processes. And we have learned very clearly with the Iraq War that going into a country, cleaning the slate and imposing completely different institutions just doesn't work. Institutions are formed through long historical processes. So that's one way in which history matters. History matters through culture as well. So one example that we used in the course is the history of the Jewish people. Jews are typically associated with having high human capital. They are very educated, high financial capital, okay, but being in a diaspora, living all over the world. And the standard assumption for this was that they were often persecuted and prohibited from owning land. And so they invested in the things they could take with them, which was liquid money and knowledge, but not assets or land or fixed assets. There are a series of papers that have come out recently that dispute this view and say that Jews were like that before the persecution started. And they look very, very far back. They look at the time of the destruction of the temple in the year 70 AD. At that time, there is a sect in Judaism, the Pharisees, of which you read about in the Bible, that become the dominant sect. And these guys had as their priority, from a purely religious point of view, that all Jews had to be able to read the Torah in the synagogue. And so they made it mandatory for fathers to educate their sons. Now, this was extremely expensive. You're talking about a very rural subsistence society in the first century. If you have a son, you want him working in the field. You do not want him in school. Now, what he's going to learn at school is how to read the Torah in the synagogue. Then that's not going to help once he goes back to working in the field. So poor Jews could not afford this and left the religion. The ones who stayed were the rich Jews, the ones that could afford an education. And that way, Jews became educated. Now, once you're educated, you have an advantage in occupations that require an education, things like being an accountant, an advisor to the king, a financier. So having been educated by this random religious rule imposed of them on them, Jews took advantage of them by specializing on the occupations that required education. Because education was not very much in demand, if they wanted to find jobs, they had to move all around. So that's the way the Jewish diasporas begin. Sure enough, there were persecutions, there were massacres, there was the Holocaust as well. That's a lot more to the future than this period. But it is difficult to link them to the actual occupational choices of the Jews. The occupational choices come from before and have to do with this cultural phenomenon, right? It's not done for an economic reason. Okay, it stands for purely cultural motives, and they determine the entire historical path of an ethnicity.
Wow.
So these are some of the things we learn in the course.
That's a great example. And so students in this class are not necessarily students that are studying economic history. They could just be studying another stream of economics in your department.
So this year I have 5 MA students, and none of them is specializing in economic history. This is what's called the field course. You learn this as part of your general economics training, and I also have an honors undergraduate student. So I have had students that have written dissertations in economic history, but those are the minority. Usually this is part of the comprehensive education in economics in the department.
That's fantastic. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you today, and it was really enjoyable just to hear about a part of a field of study that not many of us know about.
Thank you very
much.
It's been great. This has been great for me too.
That's wonderful. You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. I've just been speaking with Professor Mauricio Drelichman from the Department of Economics. If you would like to learn more about his research, you can visit his website at Mauricio, that's Mauricio. econ.ubc.ca. And so next, in 2 weeks, I will be speaking with Professor Jeffrey Byrne from the Department of History. So we'll be continuing our historical discussions, but we're going to be switching to Algeria. His research, Jeffrey Byrne, is a professor who's really looking at revolutionary Algeria in the 1960s, and we will have a discussion about his research, especially in the context of some of the North African uprisings today. If you would like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, you can visit citr.ca. And please do check out our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also email us now at prof.talk@ubc.ca. I think I'm going to end today's show with some music from Spain. You'll hear from a musician, a very well-known musician named Paco de Lucia. And it's been wonderful talking with Mauricio today, and I look forward to chatting again in a couple weeks. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for listening today.